They weren't just inside the machine as middle managers. They were the machine. They knew the game. They knew the system. They had been masters of it for years. Theirs was a modern Rome, Rome on the Potomac, an empire in miniature, a land in and unto itself. New Rome knew no economic vicissitudes. There were no vacant storefronts, no depressed housing prices, or reductions in take-home pay. Taxes, fees, fines, and lines of credit that stretched to the stars and back made sure that the treasury was awash in coin. Things in New Rome were positively booming. The future was bright indeed. That didn't mean, though, that the empire was secure. As its fortunes grew, it seemed to come under a more regular and more prolonged assault by the country class. Country class had replaced flyover country, as the new contumelious term used to describe the great unwashed living outside D.C. or the nation's other megalopoli. Through social media, a handful of sympathetic news organizations, and grassroots activism, the country class waged incessant guerrilla warfare, demanding that the new Rome be put on a diet and scaled dramatically back. As far as the new Romans were concerned, it was an odd, stupid little war waged by odd, stupid little people. They were most definitely in the minority. All of the polling showed it. Instead of shoving their faces full of McDonald's drive-thru and watching reality TV like the rest of the country-class hobbits, they were strangely obsessed with what was happening in Washington and how things should be changed. If they were so eager to dictate how it should be done in Washington, why were they sitting on their asses in Tennessee and Texas, Idaho and Indiana? Why weren't they trundling their fat little children onto buses and coming to D.C. to help lend a hand? The answer was simple, because it was beyond them. They had no idea how government worked, much less how important government workers were to its continued function. Without federal employees, it all stopped. All of it. Fees at national parks didn't get collected. School lunch regulations didn't get enforced. Borders were left unprotected, and that was only the beginning. The inmates wanted to run the asylum. There was no way that could ever be allowed to happen. Anything that grows is, by definition, alive. Washington, D.C. was no exception. As a living organism, the federal government's number one job was self-preservation. Any threat to its existence had to be dealt with. When the country class came with its pathetic rhetorical torches and meddling electoral pitchforks, New Rome was ready. It fought back with tools no one had ever seen coming. New Rome weaponized its own federal agencies, the Internal Revenue Service, the Department of Justice, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. They all swatted away each and every attack. The country class could storm the battlements over and over. They didn't stand a chance. Not only could you not fight City Hall, you couldn't survive a fight with the federal government. New Rome could take every single thing you have and put you in prison. It wasn't even a fair fight. It wasn't supposed to be. New Rome would do what it took to win, and it would do so every single time. Its responsibility to its own survival was bigger than any responsibility to its clueless constituents. If they really cared about Washington, they'd be paying much closer attention. But they didn't. And so, New Rome proceeded accordingly. The phenomenon was fascinating to Damien. Listening to the conversations around the table, he had been captivated. These were not evil people. They were actually incredibly compassionate, clear-eyed, and focused. In short, they got it. They grasped not only what was at stake, but more importantly, what needed to be done. These were reasonable people. Though not a religious man, Damien knew these people were meant to inherit the earth. It was why he had selected them. It was a spectacular night. No one was feeling any pain, and no one wanted it to end. Breaking with their locally sourced tradition, Damien dispatched Jeffrey to retrieve one of his best sauternes. It was a bottle of liquid gold, a a 1934 Chateau d'Yquem, and he had been saving it for just this very night. Its copper and orange hues reminded him of the magic bird the next phase of his operation celebrated. The $7,000 dessert wine boasted rich creme brulee, orange, caramel, flowers, spice, and butterscotch flavors, along with earthy whorls of cocoa, chocolate, and coffee. It was delicious, and the absolute best way imaginable to celebrate the rebirth of the world. Of course, it was exquisitely painful not to be able to share any of this with Helena and be able to show her off. She wasn't a member of the society, though, and thereby wasn't allowed to attend the dinner. Instead, Damien had ordered in her favorite, Italian, and had set her up in the guest house. He would join her once his other guests had left. He had Jeffrey bring out a second bottle of Chateau d'Yquem. This one was a delicious, yet much less expensive 66. Some partook, some did not. 20 minutes later, society members began to thank him and melt away into the night. Once they were gone, the woman next to him reached out and put her hand on his arm.
"What a glorious evening, Pierre," she said.
Damien smiled in response. Linda Landon had been working for the federal government for over 40 years and had seen it all. She was his linchpin in everything that was about to happen. Reaching into her shoulder bag, she pulled out a small box.
"I brought you something."
"Linda, you shouldn't have gotten me a gift."
"No, no," she stated, looking down and shaking her head. "It's just a small token."
Damien lifted the lid. Inside was a pair of silver cufflinks.
"Gordian knots," she explained. "I thought you would appreciate them."
He did indeed. It was one of his favorite ancient myths. The knot was meant to symbolize an impossible problem, solved with bold outside-the-box thinking. In the story, a man named Gordius celebrates becoming king by dedicating his chariot to Zeus and tying it to a pole with an impossible-to-unravel Gordian knot. An oracle predicts that a man will come and untie it, and that man will go on to become king of all Asia. Like the legend of the sword in the stone, many tried and failed to untie the knot. Then, Alexander the Great visited the city. He searched and searched for the loose ends of the knot so he could set to work. When he couldn't find them, he pulled out his sword and sliced right through it. Alexander then went on to conquer Asia.
"They are very handsome," he said. "Thank you."
"I'm glad you like them," Landon replied. "Now, I think you and I should talk about the—"
Damien held his finger up, suggesting she pause, as Jeffrey entered the dining room to see if there was anything else they needed.
"Perhaps another coffee?" she said.
"Make it two," Damien stated. "We will take them in the library."
Jeffrey nodded and walked back to the kitchen. Damien stood and motioned his guest into the large main hall. It was hung with magnificent oil paintings in thick, gilded frames. They depicted bucolic scenes of hunting, fishing, and farm life. Landon could only imagine how much they had cost. Beyond the grand staircase was an elegant paneled door. Damien paused just long enough to turn the handle and then step back so his guest could enter. Landon barely made it two steps inside before coming to an abrupt stop. Curled up on a couch in front of the fireplace, reading, was an attractive young woman in jeans and a rather tight sweater.
"Helena," Damien said, taken off guard, "what are you doing here?"
"I came to find a book," she replied, laying aside the leather-bound copy of Edward Pollard's The Lost Cause and standing.
She walked over and extended her hand to Damien's guest.
"My name is Helena, Helena Peshtova." "Pleased to meet you," the older woman replied coldly. "I'm Linda."
Helena waited, but the woman didn't give her last name. Damien had not intended for the two to meet. In fact, he had not intended for Helena to meet any of the society members. The dinner was a boring philanthropic obligation, he had explained. No spouses, no significant others. Helena had appeared to take it in stride, but entering the main house and establishing herself in the library communicated another message. She wanted his attention, and she would get it soon enough, plenty of it. But he needed to finish his business with Landon first.
We have some business items to finish up, he said to her. I'll find you afterward, okay?
Okay,
Helena replied, as she picked up her book and cell phone, then walked over and kissed him on the cheek. At the library door, she turned to the other woman and said,
It was nice meeting you.
Landon shot her a bitchy smile.
You too, dear.
As Helena exited, Jeffrey entered with a tray and set up the coffee service on a small table near the fireplace. Landon took a seat on the couch, removed her computer from her shoulder bag, and powered it up. Damien sat down at his antique desk.
Will you be needing anything else? Jeffrey asked.
Damien looked everything over and replied, I think we're fine. Thank you, Jeffrey. Clearing away the tray, Jeffrey opened the door and stepped out into the hallway. As he did, Damien noticed that Helena had left her cell phone charger behind. She always seemed to be forgetting it. She would forget her gorgeous head if it wasn't attached. She was always leaving that stupid charger somewhere. He thought about having Jeffrey unplug it and take it to her, but decided against it. The less that was said about her in front of Landon, the better. Though married, Landon carried a torch for Damien. He knew it and had thoroughly manipulated it. Her loyalty to him was beyond question. It was also about to be put to the ultimate test. Removing his laptop, he set it upon his desk and depressed the power button. Next to it, he placed the encrypted cell phone he had programmed for her. With a smile, he said, Let's get to work. Chapter 28 Congo, Tuesday. Harvath had made the call to scrap the Bunia airport altogether. It was too dangerous. They were better off taking their chances on the road south to Goma. The Hotel EUZ on Lake Kivu, near the Rwanda border crossing, was the perfect place for them to hole up while they waited for their jet to arrive. It was filled with mercenaries, smugglers, hookers, NGO workers, and all sorts of other characters. It reminded Harvath of the cantina scene in Star Wars. The best part was that everyone minded their own business. If you didn't want to be social, no one bothered you. It had taken Harvath all the cash he had left to organize their departure. But complicating matters was the fact that Decker had flat out refused to cooperate. She not only wouldn't help with Harvath's plan, but she also wanted to return to the Matumeni Clinic and begin to rebuild it. That, though, was absolutely out of the question. It was too dangerous. In addition to it being a crime scene, there was no telling if Hendrik's men, or the FRPI rebels for that matter, might show up there. In only a handful of days, Harvath had blazed a trail the width of a 20-lane highway through that part of Congo. It had pissed off a lot of people. The fallout was going to be intense. Leaving the country as soon as possible was the right thing to do. He had tried to convince Decker of it too, but she wouldn't listen. Finally, he had to get Beeman on the sat phone to straighten her out. Beeman made it perfectly clear that the Matumeni Clinic was off limits. He suggested she come back to the United States until things cooled down. She refused and informed him that she intended to return to Kinshasa, even though the care clinic there was still on hold. There was nothing Beeman could do to persuade her, and he told Harvath to let her go. Harvath had no trouble letting her go, but he had no intention of doing it in Bunia. She could catch a plane to Kinshasa from Goma. It would be safer there. Needless to say, Decker dug her heels in. She wanted to know where Harvath had been and why he had left her at the hotel for 2 days with Leonce and his son. He didn't owe her an explanation, but he gave her one anyway. He told her that they had gotten a lead on who had been behind the attack on the clinic, as well as the village. When he refused to give her any further details, she went supernova on him. It was blistering, and much of it was uncalled for. He let her get it out of her system and then told her to pack her bag. He told her they were taking her to the airport. Technically, that was true. He just didn't tell her which one. Once she had finished her next temper tantrum over not being taken to the airport in Bunia and had calmed down, he filled her in a little bit more on what had gone down. He had a private Medijet flying into Goma. Without telling her everything about Hendrik, he explained that he planned to smuggle him out of the country as an acute medical patient. To do that, he would need Decker's help as a doctor. She not only said no, she said hell no, and lectured him about ethics. Harvath had had just about as much as he could take from her. His bandwidth for her ideological bullshit was full. When they arrived at the hotel, he helped carry her bag up to her room and then zip-tied her in the bathroom. As soon as he had left the country, she would be released, taken to the airport, and put on a plane. Until then, Simon and Eddie would take shifts keeping an eye on her. The last thing he needed was her screwing up his departure. With the rest of Harvath's money, Jumbo scoured Goma to purchase the people and paperwork Harvath needed. Everything else would have to be borrowed. Without even being asked, Ash and Mick volunteered. As the men worked on their lists, Harvath unpacked Decker's gear. Over the phone, one of the Carlton Group's medical assets stepped him through preparation of the drugs he was going to give Hendrik. Harvath had mixed feelings about leaving. With everything he had learned, he needed to get back to the United States. There were still several accounts, though, that needed to be settled in Congo. While he wanted Hendrik's men placed on the front burner for the atrocities they had committed, the WHO lab in Angola was the U.S. government's main focus. Reed Carlton had conducted a very private briefing with the president, as well as the director of the CIA. Based on Harbath's reporting, it was decided that a highly specialized covert team from the U.S. Army's Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases at Fort Detrick, Maryland, would be sent in to investigate. Known as a Scientific Tactical Assessment Response Team, or STAR Team for short, it was a hybrid of special operations and scientific personnel. Whatever threats they encountered, be they chemical, biological, or anthropological, that is, human, the team members were equipped and trained to face them. If there was intelligence to be had at Ngoa, they would secure it and bring it back to the United States. Harvath's job was to get Hendrik out of Congo and deliver him to an interrogation team on the island of Malta. This was where Dr. Jessica Decker had refused to lend any assistance whatsoever. Normally, Harvath wouldn't have cared, but Hendrik was of high intelligence value. If he coded during the flight, it would be left to Harvath to save him. The plane wasn't going to land anywhere else but Malta. If it did, and Hendrik came to and began talking, Harvath and the pilots would be thrown into the nearest prison. The Carlton Group moved a lot of detainees via medical transport jets. The owner of Sentinel Medevac was a patriot who had been very generous to Harvath and the old man. There was no way they were going to allow two of his pilots to be incarcerated and one of his very expensive long-haul jets impounded. It was Malta or bust, which was why Harvath had spent so much time on the phone getting the dosing right. Hendrik was going to be heavily sedated, so much so he wouldn't talk, moan, or even move. Jumbo's assignment was to take care of greasing the skids at the airport and buying the appropriate health ministry paperwork. Ash and Mick were in charge of sets and props. It would all come down to mounting an absolutely convincing show. When his cell phone chimed, Harvath left Hendrik with one of the brute squad and walked down to the parking lot. He found Mick standing in front of the team's land cruisers with a smile. United Nations vehicles were white with simple black lettering for a reason. It made them easy to spot and instantly recognizable. It also made them easy to counterfeit. Both vehicles were already white, so all that they had needed was for the letters U and N to be stenciled in the right places. Mick, though, had gone a step further and had even matched the correct high-gloss black paint. Leave it to a team of special operations guys not only to get the job done, but to get it done to precise detail. Ash was standing behind LC-2 and waved Harvath over. Because the vehicle was set up to carry cargo, it made the perfect makeshift ambulance. In fact, it was quite common in Congo to see them used that way. Inside were all the things Harvath had asked for, plus a couple he hadn't. Resourceful didn't even come close to describing the two SAS men. The health ministry documents Jumbo acquired were the icing on the cake. Based on everything they had pulled together, Harvath had little doubt they were going to be able to smuggle Hendrik out without incident. This was still Congo, though, and Harvath wouldn't rest completely assured of anything until the entire country was in his rearview mirror. Back in his room, he thought about giving Decker a final opportunity to leave with him, but decided against it. She had made her decision. He couldn't risk her tanking this leg of the operation out of spite or misguided moralization. They would do fine without her. Harvath would monitor Hendrik's vitals throughout the flight and have a doctor on standby via sat phone. If anything happened, Harvath would handle it. Hendrik was going to Malta. End of story. When the pilot contacted Harvath to let him know he was on the ground, the clock began ticking. The first thing they had to do was drug Hendrik. The bound and gagged South African spun on the floor like a crocodile when he saw the syringe come out. It took Ash, Mick, and Jumbo to hold him down so Harvath could inject him. Moments later, his eyes rolled up into his head, and he was out. The men moved quickly. They changed Hendrik into a hospital gown, placed him on a stretcher, and Harvath started an IV. When the second text came in from the pilot confirming that he had completed refueling and pre-flight, Harvath told the team it was time to roll. They waited until things were clear at the side of the hotel and carried Hendrik out that way. After transferring him to the isolation stretcher in the back of LC-2, they secured his arms and legs with zip ties, and then disguised everything with hospital blankets. Harvath checked his vitals once more before closing the seams of the translucent tent. Once Hendrik was ready for transport, the team donned goggles, face masks, and disposable Tyvek coveralls. As it was just for show, they only put on one layer of gloves, but they taped them up just the same. Anyone who saw them now wouldn't want anything to do with them, much less get anywhere near them. Fear was the biggest thing Harvath was counting on. Even by third world standards, Goma International Airport was a pit. It still hadn't fully recovered from the eruption of Mount Nyiragongo over a decade before. A lake of solidified lava 200 meters wide by 1,000 meters long had swallowed up a third of its main runway and cut off access to the terminal. All of the temporary workarounds that airport authorities had come up with back then were still in place. This actually played right into Harvath's plan. Nobody at Goma International wanted a contagious patient with a highly communicable disease passing through the commercial aviation area. Nor did they want them passing through the adjacent area that all of the military and relief flights used. The airport authority wanted the patient completely isolated, and so Jumbo had arranged for the team to be admitted via a gate at the far side of the airport. When they rolled up in their UN-marked vehicles, Jumbo, in full mask, goggles, and bunny suit, lowered his window and offered his paperwork and Hendrik's blue UN laissez-passer passport for inspection. The armed soldiers looked at him like he was crazy. They were all too familiar with disease in Congo. They weren't going to exit the safety of their booth and inspect anything. In fact, they immediately shut their own window, opened the security gates, and quickly waved the convoy through. The jet's air stairs were already down as the land cruisers pulled up alongside. As instructed, the pilots remained in the cockpit and did not exit. Knowing that they were under observation, Harvath waited until they had loaded Hendrik inside the aircraft to say thank you. He shook each man's hand and told them how much he appreciated what they had done. While he would have loved to have bought them all beers and steak dinners to celebrate the completion of the assignment, his work wasn't done. They were professionals. They understood. As they filed down the stairs, Asher was the last to leave the plane. He stopped in the aircraft's door and turned to Harvath.
"If you ever come back to Africa," he said, "I'll be expecting a phone call and that steak dinner."
"You've got it," replied Harvath.
Asher stepped onto the top stair, gave the doorframe two quick taps, and shouted,
"See you, Superman,"
as he returned to the vehicles. After retracting the air stairs and closing the aircraft door, Harvath checked to make sure Hendrik was secure, and then informed the pilots that they were ready to take off. As the plane began to taxi forward, Harvath took a seat, cinched his seatbelt, and drew a deep breath. Goma International was known for its crashes, both on landing and on takeoff. He prayed Mr. Murphy had overlooked the airport today. The plane had been given first position and had been cleared for takeoff. The engines whined as the pilot throttled up the power and turned onto the runway. Harvath leaned back in his seat and looked out the window. Ash, Mick, and Jumbo had already cleared the gate and were headed back to the hotel. They were good men. Harvath had meant it when he said that he appreciated them. They had his back and had proven that he could trust them. That was everything in his book. He could only imagine the new assholes Decker was going to tear them once they cut her loose. But no matter how arrogant or nasty she was, they would take it like pros and make sure she got on her flight, even if they had to carry her onto the plane. As the jet raced down the runway and lifted off into the air, he watched Congo fall away beneath him. This was the point where he usually felt relieved. Not this time. Throughout the flight, he monitored Hendrik and kept him pumped up with sedatives. When the jet touched down in Malta, it taxied into a private hangar, where he handed over the prisoner to the interrogation team. The lead operative was a man named Vela. Harvath had never met him before, but he knew him by reputation. He was very good at what he did. He worked out of a facility masquerading as a rural Maltese farmhouse. It had been irreverently nicknamed the Solarium, because most of it was deep below ground with no windows. If Hendrik was holding anything back, Vela was going to get it. Waiting in the hangar for Harvath was a new jet and crew. The Gulfstream G650ER had been arranged by Beeman to get him back to the States as quickly as possible. It came fully catered along with a flight attendant, but the best feature as far as Harvath was concerned was the private bedroom. He had a drink just after takeoff and another with his meal. By the time he took off his clothes and hit the bed, he was more than ready to close his eyes and fall asleep. He woke up a couple of times in flight, just long enough to open his eyes, check his watch, and drift back asleep. It was a godsend, a chunk of over 8 hours of uninterrupted time. When he couldn't sleep any longer, he availed himself of the ensuite bathroom and took a long, hot shower. He then shaved as he let the water pound against his body. After drying off, he returned to the bedroom, where he found the bed made, his clothes hung up, the TV turned to a satellite news channel, and coffee waiting. Sitting on the bed was a menu offering a range of meals he could choose from before they landed. This really was the way to fly. The only thing it was missing was someone to share it with. He had no doubt Lara would love it. Who wouldn't? Scanning the menu, he made his decision and called up front to order. By the time he had dressed and walked out of the bedroom, the table had been set with new silver, new flowers, and a fresh linen tablecloth. A plate of fresh fruit was already waiting. Lara would like this a lot. The flight attendant asked if he wanted a cocktail, and he politely declined. He knew he was going to have to hit the ground running when the plane landed. After eating a double portion of bacon and eggs, he took a bottle of water back to the bedroom and closed the door. There wasn't much time before they touched down, and he wanted to use it to get his thoughts together. He didn't know how secure the plane's Wi-Fi was, so he had refrained from using his laptop. He didn't like going into the office blind, but he didn't have any choice. Security always came first. They would be landing at Dulles, and Harvath assumed the old man would send someone to pick him up. If no one was there, he would just hop in a cab. The Carlton Group was not that far away. The building's proximity to Dulles had been one of the selling points for Carlton. Taking in the crawl along the bottom of the screen, Harvath tried to get up to speed on what had transpired while he had been away. He also needed to make the mental shift from Congo mode to back home, CONUS mode, military speak for Continental United States. Once the plane had landed and come to a stop, the flight attendant lowered the air stairs, and a U.S. immigration agent boarded the plane. Harvath handed the man his passport, as well as the still-blank declaration form the flight attendant had given him. The agent looked at it and smiled. Harvath was on a very special VIP list.
"Nothing to declare, then?" he asked.
"Only that I'm glad to be home."
"It's good to have you back, sir."
The man handed Harvath's passport back to him, and Harvath picked up his bag and stepped off the plane. The crew met him at the bottom of the air stairs and thanked him for flying with them. They were extremely professional, and he thanked them in return before heading across the tarmac. Though most of his travel was done out of D.C.'s Reagan International, he knew the private aviation routine at Dulles very well and walked toward the signature flight support building. When he stepped inside, he saw that Reed Carlton had sent someone to meet him. Standing with his garment bag over her shoulder was one of his colleagues from the Carlton Group, Sloane Ashby.
"You better not have been in my house," Harvath said, as she held out the garment bag to him.
Only Reed Carlton had keys to Harvath's home, but on more than one occasion, he had given them to Ashby for one reason or another. Harvath didn't like it, not only because he didn't want her looking around his house when he wasn't there, but also because it was demeaning to an operator of Ashby's status to relegate her to errand girl status. That was the old man's style, though. No matter who you were or where you came from, you had to earn your way up in his organization. The problem with sending Ashby to select clothes for Harvath was that every time she was sent to do it, she always pushed the envelope, picking combinations Harvath would never assemble for himself.
"I didn't pick these," she said, handing over the garment bag. "I wasn't in your house. I only drove up and popped the trunk."
Harvath unzipped the bag and looked inside. It wasn't the staid dark suit, white shirt, and dark tie he would have expected from the old man, but it wasn't the envelope-pushing ensemble he would have expected from Ashby. In fact, it fell tastefully right in the middle.
"Who gave this to you?" he asked.
"Lara."
"Lara?
Did you develop a hearing problem in Congo?" she joked.
"Yeah, Lara. Why was she at my house?"
"You can ask the old man when you see him. Right now, you need to get changed into your party clothes, or he's going to chew my ass for being late. Let's go, pretty boy." Harvath had a real soft spot for Ashby. She was a smart ass, and he liked that. She could dish it out as well as she could take it. In fact, she probably dished it out too well, which was part of the reason the army had agreed to let Carlton have her. Ashby had killed so many of the enemy in Afghanistan that when a magazine back home did an unauthorized profile of her, a price was put on her head. She had taken out more bad guys than any other woman in combat and more than even most male soldiers. The army, though, couldn't risk the negative PR of a celebrity soldier, much less one who was killed or captured, so they pulled her from active duty. To add insult to injury, they refused her request to be sent to Iraq. Instead, she was detailed to Fort Bragg, where she helped train the top-secret all-female Delta Force detachment known as the Athena Project. She couldn't believe her government had sidelined her for being good at what she had been trained to do, killing bad guys. While she may have been a good instructor, she was too talented and too young to be mothballed. When Carlton offered to arrange for her to be released to his organization, she had jumped at the chance. Everyone knew that Harvath was the old man's golden boy, but like any smart manager, he was always looking to add depth to his bench. At about the same time he hired Ashby, he had hired Chase Palmer. When Harvath stepped out of the signature flight support building in his tailored Argentine blue suit, Palmer and Ashby were leaning against Palmer's car waiting for him. "Did you go to Congo or a day spa?" Palmer asked when he saw him. Being a smartass seemed to be part of the old man's corporate culture.
"It wasn't Congo," Harvath replied. "Your mom and I went to Turks and Caicos."
Palmer flipped him his middle finger as Harvath chucked his bag in the trunk and told his two colleagues to get in the car. Their conversation grew more serious as they neared the office. Ashby and Palmer were both privy to his operation, and he gave them a full recap of what had happened. It was good practice for what he would have to recount to the old man. At the office building, they cleared security and pulled into the underground garage. Harvath retrieved his bag from the trunk, and Ashby used her keycard to summon the elevator to take them upstairs. Even though the Carlton Group was a private organization, they handled classified information, and so all of their systems were built to the strictest NSA specifications. Every step had been taken to safeguard against compromising emanations, or CE as they were known. CE was any electrical, mechanical, or acoustical signal from equipment that was transmitting, receiving, processing, analyzing, encrypting, or decrypting classified information. From preventing magnetic field radiation and line conduction, to actively vibrating the windows so that conversations and keyboard strokes couldn't be intercepted, nothing had been overlooked. All of these measures, though, were largely invisible. To the untrained eye, the Carlton Group's offices resembled a successful high-tech law firm. Though Carlton believed in hiring the top people and staying out of their way so they could do their jobs, he ran a tight ship. There were no casual dress Fridays. The group's employees were the best. They were expected to dress and act like it. There were also strict rules about physical conditioning, grooming, and hygiene. The old man was old school. As a smoker himself, Carlton allowed people to smoke, but they couldn't go outside to do it. Smokers had a habit of getting too chummy and chatty with strangers and other tenants in a building. That was dangerous in the intelligence business. They milled around outside and lingered over cigarettes, wasting productive time. They also made themselves vulnerable to surveillance and approach. To cater to the smokers, he'd built what became known as the coffin, a small glass booth, barely big enough for two people at the far end of the office. It had an intense air purification system that roared so loudly you could barely hear yourself think. It wasn't supposed to be comfortable. There wasn't even a place to sit down inside. You went in, got your fix, and got out. Strangely enough, no one ever saw the old man using the coffin, and it was widely suspected he had an equally efficient, though much quieter, system placed in his office that allowed him to smoke whenever he wanted to. When Harvath stepped off the elevator and entered the offices, he half expected to find the old man waiting for him up front in the main conference room. Instead, there was a medical team. Harvath recognized the doctor. It was the same one he had been on the phone with from Congo. The man waved him into the conference room. Despite Harvath feeling perfectly fine, Carlton had ordered a full workup. They took his temperature and vitals, as well as several blood samples. After the team was finished, the doc handed Harvath a digital thermometer. He told him to take his temperature twice daily and to text him the results. Harvath tucked the device in his pocket, put his jacket on, and thanked the doctor. He then walked back toward the old man's office. He and Jessica Decker had been wearing full protective gear when they explored the Matumeni clinic, but only a respirator at the pit and nothing at all in the village, nor in their encounter with a sick FRPI rebel commander. From what he had gleaned from Hendrick, whatever the illness was that had been cooked up in Ngoa, it moved fast. The incubation period was days, not weeks. Oddly enough, Leonce and his son had been standing right there when the rebel commander had damaged one of the vials. But nothing had happened to them. They had been perfectly fine. If and when he started running a fever or had any other symptoms, then he'd raise his concern level. Right now, he tried not to think about it. Reaching the old man's office, Harvath stuck his head inside, but it was empty. As he had sent Ashby with a suit to pick him up at the airport, someone important had to be in the building, or on their way. Harvath figured it was Beeman. The old man probably wanted to give him an update, but as he was a civilian, there was a lot that had happened in Congo that couldn't be shared with him. They would have to figure out what their story was and just how far they would read Beeman in. Walking down the hall, Harvath breezed past the coffin, but still, no sign of Carlton. Unless he had left the building, there was only one other place he could be. Chapter 29. A sensitive compartmented information facility, commonly referred to in intelligence parlance as a SCIF, was an enclosed space fortified against all forms of eavesdropping and electronic surveillance, and used for processing sensitive information. The sign on the outside of the door read, Digital Ops. Harvath punched his code into the pad and stood still as the biometric reader scanned his face. There was a hiss of air as the locks released. The light changed from red to green, and he was able to open the door. Inside were three of the greatest players in the world of intelligence, and two enormous white dogs that looked like wolves on steroids. The dogs belonged to Nicholas, the Carlton Group's digital guru. He was an amazingly talented little man who suffered from primordial dwarfism and stood less than 3 feet tall. Argos and Draco, as the dogs were named, were Russian ovcharkas, the breed favored by the Russian military and the former East German border patrol. They were highly intelligent, incredibly fast, and fiercely loyal. The dogs made excellent companions and even better protectors. The last part was especially important for a man who had spent his previous career buying, selling, and hacking black market intelligence used to blackmail some of the most powerful figures in the world. In global intelligence circles, Nicholas was known only as the Troll. Not much was known about his upbringing. Even less was known about where he was now and whom he was working for. The fact that the deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency was sitting in a chair next to him, petting one of his dogs, said a lot about how far Nicholas had come. It also said a lot about how far Carlton and his relationship with the CIA had come. The old man had worked at the Central Intelligence Agency for 3 decades. One of his proudest accomplishments during that time had been establishing its counterterrorism center. But over the years, he had watched as the CIA had become more bloated and bureaucratic. Middle managers more concerned with protecting their own careers than the country they had sworn to serve fueled a risk-averse culture that was more focused on avoiding failure than securing success. There were great men and women at the CIA, tons of them, but desk jockeys better suited to IBM than the world of international espionage were hamstringing them. When the agency began paying foreign intelligence agencies to run ops for them, Carlton had had enough. Tendering his resignation, he left and created his own company. Based on the CIA's precursor, the OSS, the Carlton Group hired the best intelligence and special operations people it could find. They broke all the rules with only one goal in mind: to keep America and her citizens safe, no matter what the cost. Thanks to the frustration with the CIA's broken culture and the agency's inability to conduct effective espionage, government contracts rolled in, especially from the Department of Defense. But when a new president entered the White House, things at the CIA began to change. He named 2 highly respected operatives to take the No. 1 and No. 2 slots. Along with the Oval Office, they had begun to repair that broken culture and turn things around. It was an amazing snapshot to see Nicholas, Reed Carlton, and Lydia Ryan all sitting there in the skiff together. Harvath liked Ryan. The product of an Irish father and a Greek mother, she was a tall, beautiful woman in her early 30s, with dark hair and intense green eyes, but that wasn't why Harvath liked her. He liked her because she was smart, off-the-charts smart, and a hell of a field operative. The fact that she was good-looking didn't hurt, but Harvath had always found intelligence incredibly attractive. It was what drew him to Lara, and was part of what had created a spark with Decker. He could never be with a stupid woman. As a rule, though, he worked hard to keep his business and personal lives separate. Stepping into the skiff, the dogs leapt up to greet Harvath first, and he scratched both of them behind the ears. He had not only fought to get Nicholas his job, but he had also fought to get Carlton to allow him to bring the dogs to work. It was obvious from the start that Harvath had appointed himself the little man's guardian. When the old man had resisted Argos and Draco coming to the office, Nicholas had threatened to sue him for violating the Americans with Disabilities Act, claiming they were service animals. It was patently ridiculous, and they all got a good laugh out of it. In the end, Carlton relented and made a special exemption for Nicholas. The dogs quickly became unofficial mascots of the company. That wasn't to say that Nicholas's transition into the group had been without incident. Before Harvath had brought him in, Nicholas had been a full-on criminal. He had dealt in the theft and black market sale of highly sensitive, often classified information. From heads of corporations to heads of state, he had developed an impressive list of both clients and enemies. The day after he started work at the Carlton Group, the sign identifying his skiff as Digital Ops had been replaced with one that read The Lollipop Guild, an insulting reference to the Munchkins from The Wizard of Oz. When Harvath had heard about it, he went ballistic. It had taken him less than 15 minutes to track down the man who had done it. Harvath cornered him in the men's room, and it took every ounce of restraint he had not to beat him to a pulp right there. The man was indignant and made it clear what a mistake he thought it was to bring a criminal like Nicholas into their midst. Harvath didn't care and told him that if he ever got near Nicholas again, he would put a bullet in his head and dump his body where his family would never find it. Immediately after Harvath had left the men's room, the man had bolted to his superior to register a complaint. A no-bullshit Iraq war vet, the superior director told him that if he didn't shut up and get back to work, he'd save Harvath the bullet and shoot him himself. Word quickly got around that anybody who screwed with Nicholas would have to answer to Harvath, and that Harvath had carte blanche to do whatever he wanted.
"Look who's here," Nicholas exclaimed, as Harvath coaxed the dogs back so he could shut the door.
"About time," remarked Carlton. "What do we got, Nicky?" Theirs was another relationship that had come a long way. A really long way. The old man had originally been dead set against hiring Nicholas. Now, they sounded like bowling buddies.
"Why don't we start with the drone footage?" Nicholas replied.
"What drone footage?" asked Harvath as he grabbed a seat.
"Clifton Farm, Virginia, northwest of D.C.
He looked at Lydia Ryan.
"Whose drone? Yours or ours?"
"Yours," she replied.
"The Central Intelligence Agency is forbidden from conducting domestic surveillance operations." Harvath smiled and then looked back at Nicholas.
"What were we doing with a drone there?"
"Paying a visit to Mr. Pierre Damien."
After Harvath had learned about the Ingoa lab, he had pressed Hendrick for information about who he was working for and where his laissez-passer had come from. It took a lot more water, but eventually he gave up a name. Pierre Damien. Before leaving Bunya, Harvath filed his report and asked Carlton about Damien. The old man ran his name and came back with his dual Canadian-U.S. citizenship, his business background, the companies he was involved with, his current posting as Under Secretary General of the United Nations Population Fund, and then all of his anti-America, anti-Israel, save the planet stuff. There was nothing that pointed to an involvement with bioweapons or terrorism of any sort. When Harvath had said as much, the old man had replied, "They don't normally take out ads in the paper." He was right. It normally wasn't until after, but a man like Damien would never publicly take credit for any sort of outbreak or attack.
"Have you seen this footage yet?"
Harvath asked Ryan, as it began playing on one of the large flat-panel monitors along the wall. The deputy director shook her head.
"We were waiting for you."
From what he could see of it, Clifton was an amazing estate. Not only was there the manor house and the rolling manicured grounds, there appeared to be a fully functioning farm with lots of animals, pastures, and support buildings. The estate even had its own road system.
"Not bad," Harvath remarked.
Nicholas toggled a small joystick and sped the footage forward. There was a man standing outside the main house near its long infinity pool. Pulling up a file photo of Pierre Damien, he ran that piece of drone footage through their facial recognition system. A blue digital overlay appeared and announced, "Match." Seconds later, the words, "Match ID" appeared, and columns of data pertaining to Pierre Damien unspooled.
"This is definitely our guy," stated Nicholas.
Harvath leaned forward and studied his face.
"How did you know where to look for him?"
"As soon as you came up with his name, we started searching. He had flown in the day before and cleared passport control and customs via private aviation at Dulles International. We had a timestamp, so all I did was pull the surrounding CCTV footage."
Nicholas brought the footage up on another monitor as he continued speaking.
"That also gave us the vehicles meeting him at the airport and their license plates. Traffic and other CCTV cameras got us as far as Berryville, Virginia, outside Leesburg. Then we lost him."
"How did you pinpoint him to Clifton Farm then?"
"Architectural Digest," the little man said with a smile. "Damien is a publicity hound. He posed for a spread 6 years ago. It came up in a generic web search. There was a satellite scheduled to be overhead about that time, so we requested some pictures, and voila."
Nicholas punched a few keys on his keyboard, and satellite images of the same SUVs that had picked up Damien and his party at the airport were shown parked at the manor house. Close-ups of the license plates confirmed it.
"Wait, back up a second," said Ryan. "The woman traveling with Damien, can you isolate her from the CCTV footage and run it against passport control and customs?"
The little man nodded and got to work. Moments later, he popped several images up on the screen and replied,
"Helena Peshtova, 37 years old, Czech national."
Ryan studied the images and smiled.
"She may be a Czech national, but she's technically an Israeli intelligence asset."
"You know her?"
Harvath asked.
"We crossed paths multiple times in the sandbox. Amman, Beirut. The last time was in Doha. The Mossad uses her for their honey traps."
Nicholas brought up the drone footage of her and ran all the images through his facial recognition system. The blue overlay popped up instantly, declaring, "Match ID." Unlike Damien, there was no publicly available information about her. As far as they could tell, she didn't even have a social media account.
"So the Mossad are looking at Damien as well," said Harvath. "Same reason, or something else?"
"There's one way to find out,"
Ryan replied, as she opened a new window on her laptop and hopped on the secure network back to Langley. After a few seconds, she had what she was searching for and turned her screen so the others could see it.
"Who's that?"
"Ben Zion Mordecai. Bensi, for short. He's part of the Metzidah, the Mossad's Special Operations Division. According to our people, he's also Helena's handler."
"Do we know where he is?" said Harvath.
"Probably in Israel, most likely Tel Aviv, unless he's on assignment somewhere." "Can you send his picture to my screen?"
Nicholas asked. Ryan nodded and sent it over.
"Do you have anything else? Date of birth, military service, aliases, and known associates?"
Ryan scanned the file, copied what she felt comfortable sharing, and sent it to Nicholas, who had received Mordecai's picture and now put it up on the screen. Harvath looked at Ryan and asked,
"Who do you have in Israel who can reach out to Mordecai to find out what's going on?"
"Knowing the Mossad," she replied, "they may not want to tell us."
"If they want to be that way," Carlton interjected, "tell them we're going to bounce her, and make sure they know that we're going to be very loud about it. If they don't want their op blown, they're going to have to share. We don't care if they like it or not."
"Okay, I'll have to make some phone calls. The first thing we need to do is find out if Mordecai is in Israel."
"He isn't," stated Nicholas, who had been working furiously at his keyboard.
All eyes in the room turned and focused on him.
"What do you think?"
he asked, popping up an image from a European airport's CCTV camera.
"Is that him?"
Before anyone could answer, the blue overlay appeared with the word match.
"It looks like you'll get to ask Bensi Mordecai your questions in person," Nicholas stated as he read the information on the screen. "He's inbound from Switzerland. His flight arrives at Dulles in 2 hours."
Chapter 30. In the world of intelligence, biometric technology was a blessing and a curse. Facial recognition made it easier to identify and locate terrorists, but it also made it very difficult for spies to slip in and out of different countries while using an assumed identity. After the 9/11 attacks, the United States cracked down particularly hard, requiring biometric scanning of visitors at its ports of entry. Only U.S. citizens were allowed to bypass these requirements, which was exactly why Bensi Mordecai had acquired an authentic American passport under the name of Vincent Geller. The real Geller was an American Jew from Miami who had wanted to do his part for Israel and had been recruited by the Mossad. In exchange for surrendering his legitimate identity, he was set up in a new life with a monthly stipend. The U.S. government had never been the wiser.
"Excuse me, sir," said a pair of ICE agents at Dulles as they approached Mordecai.
He was standing in the U.S. citizen lane, waiting for his passport to be inspected. Mordecai acted as if they were addressing someone else, but it was obvious that they were speaking to him.
"Me?"
"Yes, sir. Please step out of the line." Mordecai showed them his passport.
"I'm in the right spot."
Both agents put their hands on their weapons.
"Right now, sir," the lead agent ordered.
The people standing near Mordecai nervously backed away from him.
"No problem," Bensi said, making sure the officers could see his hands.
Once Mordecai had stepped out of the line, they closed on him. One agent covered him while the other put him in handcuffs. Flying often exacerbated his arthritis. Despite having taken 2 pills, plus downing a handful of scotches en route, his hands were still killing him. The force with which he had been cuffed, in addition to how tightly the cuffs had been applied, sent ripples of red-hot pain shooting through his entire body. The agents walked him out of passport control and down a small corridor to a series of interrogation rooms. Unlocking one of the doors, the agents showed him inside. It wasn't very large, just 15 by 15. It was all white, with bright fluorescent overhead lighting. There was no two-way glass, just a boring formica table and 4 plastic chairs. Mordecai was instructed to sit. As he knew any innocent person would, he had protested the entire way, getting more indignant as he went. He railed about being a taxpayer and raised his constitutional rights. It was quite a convincing performance, but the ICE agents had been told to ignore everything he said, not to offer him anything, and not to speak to him. Soon after he sat down, there was a knock on the door. He looked up as an attractive woman with dark hair and green eyes entered. She was accompanied by a well-dressed man who crossed to the other side of the room and leaned casually against the wall. The woman instructed the agents to remove Mordecai's cuffs and then asked them to wait outside. Once they were gone, she sat down at the table and set a closed file folder in front of her.
Mr. Mordecai, she said. Do you know who I am?
My name's not Mordecai, he replied. It's Geller, Vincent Geller. I'm from Miami. I am an American citizen. You have no right to detain me like this. Those officers have my passport.
Mr. Mordecai, she continued. My name is Lydia Ryan. I'm deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, you and I can play games, or we can work together. What's it going to be?
I wish I could help you, but I can't. My name's Geller, not Mordecai.
Harvath shifted his weight and moved a little closer.
Who's he? Mordecai asked.
Never mind, Ryan replied, removing a photograph and sliding it over to him. Let's talk about Helena.
I'm sorry. I don't know who she is. You have the wrong guy.
Harvath moved so quickly, Mordecai didn't even see him coming. He was just about to strike him when Ryan held up her hand and stopped him.
Mr. Mordecai, I'm treating you with respect out of professional courtesy, she stated, but there's a limit to just how far that courtesy goes. I highly recommend you don't push it. Am I making myself clear?
Mordecai remained silent.
We know Helena is here. We know she is with Damien. We want to know why.
Mordecai opened his mouth to speak, but Ryan held up her hand to cut him off. If I hear the name Vincent Geller one more time, I'll have you rendered to a black site, and we can continue our conversation there. Is that clear?
The Israeli sat perfectly still and said nothing, his face unreadable.
At some point, Mr. Mordecai, you are going to tell me what I want to know. The only question is when, and how difficult you want to make this for Helena. If you work with me, maybe I allow your operation to continue. If not, maybe we put a bag over Helena's head and render her to a black site as well. Maybe I'll give Pierre Damien everything I have in this file and let him decide what he wants to do with her. Part of me thinks it would be fun to get my matches out and watch all of you burn. And unless you give me a good reason not to, that's exactly what I might do.
Ryan then leaned back in her chair and said nothing further. Out of the corner of her eye, she could see Harvath ready to strike if Mordecai made one false move. Slowly, he reached his gnarled hand out for the file. Ryan came forward and put her hand down on top of it.
That belongs to me, she said, not you. You don't get to see what we have until you start cooperating.
She's small time. If I cooperate, will you let her go? Mordecai asked.
I know exactly what she is, Mr. Mordecai. What I want to know is why you have put her next to Damien.
The Israeli smiled and shook his head.
Do you know what a pain in the ass Pierre Damien has been for Israel?
I've got a pretty good idea, but that doesn't answer my question.